comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Britain has announced the permanent deployment of two warships in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between the U.S. and China. Britain's Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the U.K. will permanently assign two ships in the region by the end of this year. He made the announcement in a joint press conference with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo on Tuesday.
Following on from the strike group's inaugural deployment, the United Kingdom will permanently assign two ships in the region from later this year, as well as contributing a littoral response group in the coming years to come.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and it hosts the biggest concentration of U.S. military forces outside of the U.S., including ships, aircraft, and troops. The deployment would be after a strike group consisting of U.K.'s Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier and escort ships sailed through the waters in the South China Sea in September. The Queen Elizabeth is being escorted by two destroyers, two frigates, two support vessels, and ships from the U.S. and the Netherlands. It will come to Japan through the South China Sea, parts of which are claimed by China and Southeast Asian countries, with stops in India, Singapore, and South Korea. In a statement on the deployment, Pentagon spokesperson congratulated Britain for its, quote, commitment to an interconnected network of allies and partners who mutually cooperate and support freedom of navigation and a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific region.
These are actually illusionary entities. Yes, they have sets of laws and they are separate countries, but the globalists who run the United States and the United Kingdom work together as one entity. So what we have is two countries in which the citizens are taught from young age that they live in a sovereign state. But in fact, the two countries of the UK and the US are both under the basic control of a globalist elite.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and has, since 2014, built artificial islands on reefs and installed military bases on them. UK's Defense Secretary has said that London would also eventually deploy a littoral response group to the Pacific. That's a unit of Marines trained to undertake missions including evacuations and anti-terrorism operations.
The UK and the United States function as one entity, especially when they have a common target, which in this time is China and in a secondary level, Iran.
UK's latest policy announcements are in line with U.S.'s anti-China drive. The Biden administration's approach toward China is taking shape. Many believe Biden will continue the policies of his predecessor to contain China. While the U.S. has seemingly reduced its involvement in West Asia, the American military has sought to refocus its attention on preparing for a conflict with its major rivals, China and Russia, which it considers to be major competition in the insatiable U.S. quest for power and influence. However, Washington's economy and military power is on the wane, and whether Washington likes it or not, it has to change its warmongering policies and adopt a rather more cooperative one, something that is not likely to happen anytime soon.
The United States runs what is typically called a protection racket. You must pay to buy United States weapons and defense systems in order not to be threatened by the boogeymen that they create out of other independent countries. So the United States is always leaning on its so-called allies because, in effect, with the exception of England, with the exception of the UK, all of the other countries are military protectorates or socio-economic and military colonies of the United States.
How the Biden administration actually deals with thorny issues between the two countries is yet to be seen. It will depend on how China responds to U.S. actions. Given the strong negative public sentiments towards each other and their increasingly divergent domestic political practices, the truly benign strategic competition still remains difficult, if not impossible, to achieve.
The Israeli regime is in hot water over a major scandal triggered by revelations that an Israeli-made spyware has been sold to some governments to target journalists, dissidents, and political leaders. Data leaked to an international alliance of news outlets shows the Pegasus spyware was sold to a group of countries, including the repressive regimes of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, which have notorious human rights records. It has been disclosed that Israel's Ministry of Military Affairs played an important role in choosing the customers that can buy the cutting-edge cyber spying tool. Some sources say Israeli authorities pushed for Saudi Arabia to be added to the list of customers that get the spyware. International pressure is mounting on Israel for enabling gross abuses by approving export licenses for the powerful spying tool to these states. Why was Tel Aviv so eager to make sure regimes like Saudi Arabia will have the sophisticated tool?
It helps them to control their countries. It helps to get them to be on the same side as Israel, because that's typically repressive regimes find Israel to be a, you can call it a good alliance, if you will. So this is what's happening, and it's happening now with the repressive Arab regimes in a way that it did not happen in the past.
U.S. media recently reported that Israel encouraged the technology company that developed Pegasus to continue to cooperate with the Saudis even after it was revealed that the regime ordered and planned the gruesome assassination of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The Israeli regime seems to be trying to control damage from the scandal. It has set up a task force to manage the fallout from the revelations amid an international outcry.
Iranian citizens throughout the year.
Investigations show that the Israeli spyware has been used against prominent activists, journalists, politicians, dissidents, or those close to them. A case in point is Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed and dismembered in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. The mobile phones of a number of people close to him, including his wife, were allegedly hacked into by a Pegasus operator. A close friend of Khashoggi, who was the ex-director general of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network, is believed to have been targeted. Meanwhile, outspoken Saudi women's rights activist Lujain al-Hathloul was apparently another victim. The Guardian says she was selected for possible hacking by Pegasus just weeks before she was arrested in the UAE in 2018 and then forcibly returned to the autocratic kingdom. Meanwhile, an investigation suggests that Princess Latifa, who was running from her father, the ruler of Dubai, was captured in 2018 using the Israeli phone hacking spyware Pegasus. The Washington Post reports that phone numbers of friends and associates of the princess were on the long list of phone numbers of people believed to have been targeted using the spyware. Israeli authorities seem to be having a tough time trying to contain the scandal as major Western media outlets are involved in revealing the details. Israel, with its top-end surveillance capabilities, has always been a major player in the spying world. Many observers believe the revelation suggests that the regime will not hesitate to share experience and technology in the field with governments that it wants to be friendly with.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini's testament. In today's program, we're going to discuss another part of the Imam's testament where he exposes the enemy's plots for forging rift between universities and seminaries. Please stay with us. Seminaries have a long history in Iran, while modern universities are considered new institutions, although the older form of academic education dates back to over 1,000 years in Iran. This is proved by the Jondi Shapur University in Khuzestan province, which dates back to the Sassanid era. The first modern university was founded in Iran in 1934, and by the name of Tehran University. However, seminaries date back to the first Islamic centuries. Seminaries have shouldered the responsibility of educating Iranian teenagers and young people before the entry of university to the country. As a result of Western propaganda, seminaries are considered as a center of religious teaching with no link to rationality and rational education. But with the entry of faithful and devoted students into universities in the 1950s, gradually there emerged congruity and convergence between these two educational institutions. Alongside the formation and reinforcement of the despotic climate in the country and further assistance between university and seminary students, the political ruling system was more and more criticized by both centers. Imam Khomeini's high emphasis on necessity of cooperation between universities and seminaries broke the negative mentality among the members of the two centers and society at large. Furthermore, the presentation of new political and revolutionary ideas by him strengthened his base among academics. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that unity between universities and seminaries would lead to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. After the triumph of the Islamic Revolution too, he considered this cooperation and unity very effective for the growth and bolstering of the Islamic Republic system of government. In view of this, he wrote in his testament, "Among the devilish schemes of the big colonial and imperial powers or exploitative powers that have been implemented for many years and has reached its climax since the era of Reza Khan and pursued by Muhammad Reza I, different ways is to isolate the clergy. In the era of Reza Khan, it was pursued through pressure, through suppression, defrocking, imprisonment, exile, disrespect, execution, and so on. And in the era of Muhammad Reza, it was pursued by scheme and other ways, one of which was forging hostility between academic and clergyman, which with propaganda was carried out in this field. Unfortunately, due to the unawareness of both strata about this devilish plot of superpowers, it yielded greatly. On the one hand, from schools to universities, it was tried to appoint the teachers, professors, and university chancellors from among Western educated individuals, and those who were deviated from Islam and belonged to other religions, and the committed faithful were placed in a minority in order to train the effective stratum, which would take the rule in future from childhood to adolescence up to youth in a way that would hate religion in general and Islam in particular, and that they would hate clergymen. And at the same time, these were introduced by Britain and later on by the advocates of capitalism and feudalists and supporters of backwardness and opponents of civilization and sublimity. On the other hand, this wicked propaganda, they would frighten clergymen, promoters and devotees of universities and academics, and would accuse them of not respecting religion, promiscuity and opposition to the symbols of Islam and religion. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, further wrote in his testament, "The result of those policies is that politicians and statesmen were opposed to religion, Islam and clergymen, and the faithful, whereas the masses of people who liked religion and clergymen were opposed to the government and the ruling system and whatever belonged to it. And the deep differences between the government and nation and academic and clergymen opened the way for looters to the extent that all affairs of the country were in their power and all reserves of the nation were poured into their pockets, so that you saw what happened and what was going to happen to this oppressed nation. Now, with the grace of God and the struggle of the nation, from clergymen to academics and to ordinary people, workers, farmers, and other strata of society have torn up the chains of captivity and broken the dam of the power of superpowers and rescued the country from them and their lackeys. My advice to the present and the future generation is that they should not neglect this history, and that the academics and the courageous young people and clergymen and students of Islamic sciences consolidate the bond of friendship as much as possible between the seminaries and the universities, and never be negligent of the plots and schemes and conspiracies of the deceitful enemy. And as soon as they see a person or persons who try with their words or deeds to sow differences between the seminary and the university, to guide and advise them. And if it is not effective, leave him alone and isolate him so that they do not let the conspiracy to take root.
Since mid-July, Cuba has seen a series of anti-government protests. The protesters say they are desperate, poor, hungry, and fed up with Havana's inability to meet their basic needs. Yet there are documents that show Washington is seriously embroiled in these rare events.
Folks, I want to start by recognizing the remarkable protests that are taking place in Cuba. The Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime. And I don't think we've seen anything like this protest in a long, long time, if quite frankly, ever.
Everything began in the town of San Antonio de los Baños in the west of the country. The protest came after a power outage left the residents without electricity during the summer heat. They were then encouraged and even led by artists, especially hip-hop musicians, to take to the streets. Florida Senator Marco Rubio enthusiastically tweeted, "For those new to the issue of Cuba, the protests we are witnessing were started by artists, not politicians. Song, Patria y Vida, powerfully explains how young Cubans feel," referring to a track by Cuban rapper UTL. Similarly, the New York Times published an in-depth article about the song and the role it had in galvanizing the movement. But both the U.S. Senator and the U.S. Daily failed to mention Cuban rappers like UTL have long been on the payroll of the White House to sow discontent in Cuba. The latest grant publications of the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, which front the CIA, show that the U.S. government is trying to get into the Cuban arts community so as to further its so-called regime change agenda in the Caribbean nation. In the words of Tracy Eaton, a journalist who runs the Cuba Money Project, the State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the U.S. Agency for Global Media have all financed programs to support Cuban artists, journalists, bloggers, and musicians, adding, "It's impossible to say how many U.S. tax dollars have gone toward these programs over the years because details of many projects are kept secret." The hip-hop scene in particular has long been a target for American agencies like the NED and USAID for its biting critiques of Cuban society. Currently, a grant offer from USAID is offering $2 million worth of funding to groups that use culture to bring about social change in Cuba.
It would be great to see the United Nations step up and condemn that. I know that President Biden has spoken that they're trying to see what they can do to get the internet back up. That would be important. We're all doing whatever we can.
Meanwhile, the U.S. House Appropriations budget has also set aside up to $20 million for democracy programs in Cuba. Needless to say, any mention of democracy in Cuba is all but synonymous with regime change. But for what the Americans call a regime change, they have pinned their hopes on economic crises in the country, and they've done their best in this regard. As Professor Aviva Chomsky of Salem State University, author of A History of the Cuban Revolution, put it, the U.S. embargo or blockade is one, not the only cause of Cuba's economic crisis. The U.S. has overtly and continuously said that the goal of the embargo is to destroy Cuba's economy so that the government will collapse. While it is not true to say that all those marching in the protests are on the pay list of the U.S., it is not also true to say that the protests are all due to internal problems. On some occasions, a number of demonstrators march underneath the U.S. flag, and the protests were immediately endorsed by Washington. Meanwhile, Florida Congressman Anthony Sabatini called for regime change on the island, tweeting, high-ranking communist officials in Cuba should be given an ultimatum now. Either immediately assist in the transition of government away from communism or be prosecuted and executed thereafter. Hashtag SOS Cuba. At the same time, corporative media have shown great interest in covering the protests while constantly downplaying the effect of U.S. sanctions. For example, the Washington Post published a feature in favor of the protesters, claiming the Cuban president was reacting with predictable thuggishness, blaming everything on the United States and the U.S. trade embargo. That's why government documents openly state that the goal of the U.S. sanctions is to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and the overthrow of the government. Oddly enough, a great number of media outlets used images of pro-government movements to show the support scope of the anti-government protests. The Guardian, Fox News, The Financial Times, NBC, and Yahoo News all falsely claimed a picture of a large socialist gathering was, in fact, an anti-government demonstration. Meanwhile, Twitter has long shown enmity towards Havana. In 2019, the corporation suspended almost every Cuban state media account, in addition to those belonging to the Communist Party. That said, in 2010, USAID secretly created a Cuban social media app called Zunzunio, often described as Cuba's Twitter. The aim was to set up a platform to spew out Cubans' regime change propaganda and then direct them to protests with the ultimate aim of fomenting a color-style revolution. Since the late 19th century, the Americans have always been trying to interfere in Cuba, either through invasion, occupation, or subversion. In 1961, they launched a failed invasion of the island. They reportedly attempted to kill Fidel Castro hundreds of times. Then they decided to focus mostly on blockade and economic war, a policy they've been pursuing for over six decades. They hope that economic misery will bring the nation to its knees, but so far the resistance of the Cuban people has dashed those hopes.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Greenpeace Australia called the recent World Heritage Committee vote a victory for one of the most cynical lobbying efforts in recent history. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, A Day of Shame, Australia Lobbying Thwarts Push to List Great Barrier Reef as Endangered. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. An intense lobbying campaign by the pro-fossil fuel Australian government succeeded recently in keeping the Great Barrier Reef off a list of World Heritage Sites considered in danger, despite experts' warnings that the biodiverse ecosystem is increasingly imperiled by the global climate emergency. The 21-nation World Heritage Committee, organized by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, watered down a push to categorize the Great Barrier Reef as endangered, an effort that the right-wing Australian government fervently opposed with the backing of Saudi Arabia and other oil-friendly countries. Instead of designating the reef as in danger, the World Heritage Committee recently instructed the government of Australia to produce a progress report on the structure's condition by February 2022. David Ritter, CEO of Greenpeace Australia, said in a statement recently that the vote is a victory for one of the most cynical lobbying efforts in recent history. Under the UNESCO Treaty, the Australian government promised the world it would do its utmost to protect the reef. Instead, it has done its utmost to hide the truth, said Ritter. This is not an achievement. It is a day of shame for the Australian government. Leslie Hughes, spokesperson for Climate Council, an Australia-based advocacy organization, slammed the government's lobbying blitz and said lawmakers must stop censoring science. The science is clear. Climate change is accelerating and is the single greatest threat to the Great Barrier Reef. In the past 5 years, it has been repeatedly and severely damaged by 3 marine heat waves, said Hugh, a professor of biology at Macquarie University in Sydney, adding, until we see credible climate action and the phasing out of fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas, the situation will worsen, not improve. The Great Barrier Reef is in danger, and trying to hide the facts won't change a thing, unquote. Home to hundreds of types of coral and more than 1,000 species of fish, the Great Barrier Reef has been badly damaged in recent years by mass coral bleaching fueled by warming ocean temperatures, which is why scientists have been pushing Australia and the international community to formally recognize the system as endangered.
The World Heritage Committee's vote came a month after UNESCO issued a report warning that the Great Barrier Reef's condition has further deteriorated from poor to very poor due to human-caused climate change. The UN body advised that the reef be listed among the world's endangered sites, a call endorsed by scientists around the world. UNESCO's recommendation sparked furious backlash from the Australian government, which launched an aggressive lobbying push to prevent the listing. As The Guardian reported, more than a dozen ambassadors flew from Canberra to Cairns, Queensland, for a snorkeling trip on the reef, and Australia's Government Minister Susan Lee was dispatched to Europe on an RAAF diplomatic jet to visit Budapest, Madrid, Sarajevo, Paris, Oman, and the Maldives. Australia, a major producer and exporter of coal and gas, initially won support from oil-rich Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, both members of the committee, to delay any decision on the danger listing until at least 2023, the outlet noted. But after an interjection from Norway, the committee decided instead the reef's health would be considered again at next year's meeting. Sarah Hanson-Young, an Australian senator with the Greens Party, warned following the vote that the decision to delay the endangered listing for the Great Barrier Reef is ridiculous and will cost Australia in the long term. Everyone knows the climate crisis is threatening the reef, she added. Delay is denial and a stop to fossil fuels.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate, June 4, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. In 1329 and 1330, according to the solar calendar, the years marked by the national movement, a certain movement came into being, bringing the people to the streets, thereby nationalizing Iran's oil and snatching it away from the English. However, 1-2 years later, an English and an American coup was launched, helping Mohammad Reza to resume another complex and very dangerous dictatorship for long periods of time. These incidents have taken place in the world. They were anticipating that fate for us by looking at the past. However, not only was the revolution and Imam Khomeini's system not dissolved, and not only did it not come to a halt, but it also became more powerful on a daily basis, refusing to surrender and to back off. It displayed and showcased its independence with each passing day. It accomplished great feats and overcame the obstacles. And they created so many obstacles on the way of this revolution and the system, all sorts, including political, economic, security, and various other obstacles. The Islamic Republic overcame all of them, and it galloped forward. Today, the Islamic Republic is more developed and advanced than when it first began work 40 years ago. and it is better in every aspect by God's favor and grace. The secret to the survival of the Islamic Republic. Well, a question arises here about the secret to this survival and this progress. Why did the Islamic Republic not suffer the same fate as other political systems and revolutions despite all that enmity? What is the reason and what is the secret of this? I will tell you that the magnificent and pride-generating secret to the survival of this system could be summed up in two words: Republic and Islamic. The harmony between these two is the secret to the survival, and the organism that has been formed out of these two words should be protected, both the Republic and Islamic aspect of it, both the people and Islam. Republic means people, and Islamic means coming from Islam. This is the same as religious democracy.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the World with Reporters.
This is exactly what's happening to our whole society today.
This year's International Quds Day Conference was held to coincide with the 7-year anniversary of the 2014 Quds Day massacre. The carnage happened when 35 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria who are protesting the persecution of Palestinians by the Israeli regime were killed by Nigerian army troops. On 25 July 2014, a street protest was marred by the fatal shooting of dozens of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, including 3 biological sons of Sheikh Zazaki.
We are marking the 7-year anniversary of that dark day because it was shocking to us and it was shocking to many Nigerians, whereby 3 of our leaders' biological sons were gunned down. They were taken to the barracks, to the army barracks. They were tortured to death. Meanwhile, 30 of our members were gunned down.
In a statement, the Nigerian army said the soldiers acted in self-defense, a claim the Islamic movement dismissed as preposterous.
That's nonsense, because they dispatched a contingent of the Nigerian army to go and lie down in a nearby farm, a sugarcane farm, bottle ready, armed, well armed, as if they are going to meet a soldiers of another country, a foreign country. And then if they say they acted in self-defense, where are the guns they recover? They recover from the 33 people they kill. They were just bloodthirsty criminals who are ready to kill the Shiite community.
Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters were still mourning the 2014 Quds Day massacre when another mass killing took place in Zaria in 2015 at the hands of the Nigerian army, resulting in the deaths of over 340 other members of the movement. Meanwhile, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have remained in detention in the Kaduna Correctional Center. A Kaduna State High Court judge is expected to issue the final ruling on the Sheikh Zazaki case on Wednesday, July 28, where, according to his lawyers, no case can be made against the Islamic cleric. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Based on a statement released by Afghanistan's Ministry of Interior, to curb violence and limit the Taliban movements, a night curfew has been imposed in 31 provinces across the country, except in Kabul, Panjshir and Nangarhar. This comes as many have argued that imposing a night curfew means that the war is in the own backyard of the residents of cities across the country, a fact that can further spread fear and concern among locals. Many others view this as an indirect call on the locals to take the threats coming from Taliban advances seriously and resolutely stand alongside Afghanistan's national defense and security forces to defeat the Taliban.
The night curfew highlights the government's need for public support in fight against the Taliban. We have to put our weight behind the Afghan national defense and security forces.
Talks between Afghan government and the Taliban have failed to achieve a tangible result so far.
The nighttime curfew will make the things difficult for Taliban. They will be deprived of free maneuvering even behind the entrance gates of some cities. This is because they will be targeted easily by the Afghan armed forces.
Afghan troops have recaptured some areas in a western city which was attacked by the Taliban. The Taliban, who have stepped up their attacks since the withdrawal of the foreign forces, insist that there would not be peace in the country until the removal of President Ghani from power and presence of a new negotiated government in Kabul. In response, the Afghan government argues that the militants need to firstly put their guns on the ground and approve the Afghan constitution as a red line for both the government and people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting, and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden, and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad Al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Pola Odin, and Anas Al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. Al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire life.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus. Yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates?
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman visited Seoul this week to meet with her South Korean counterparts to discuss North Korea, China, and other issues. She stressed what she sees as the two states' mutual concerns in remarks also aimed at Beijing.
Our two countries are bound together by our common security interests, by our economic ties, by our common values of democracy and freedom. We will continue to discuss regional challenges, including actions that run counter to the interests of the United States and the Republic of Korea and threaten to undermine the rule-based international order.
South Korea has tried to balance its relations between China, now its largest trading partner, and the U.S., its security guarantor. And Seoul recognizes it needs the U.S. if it wants progress on peace with North Korea. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman once again voiced Washington's desire to bring North Korea to the negotiating table and its support for inter-Korean engagement, issues of primary importance to South Korean President Moon Jae-in. But Washington's support on those issues may come with strings attached, as the U.S. seeks its Asian allies' backing in its ongoing crisis with China.
Joining the U.S. containment strategy against China might be costly for South Korea, say experts. Large demonstrations against the deployment of the American anti-missile defense system, THAAD, erupted when it was deployed in 2017. China then slapped South Korea with heavy economic sanctions over hosting the U.S. missile Shield.
It's a tragic history that powerful countries have used the Korean Peninsula as their battlefield. Preventing that history from repeating itself is most important for South Korea to avoid becoming entangled in a battle between the U.S. and China. It must firmly stake out a neutral position, even though it would cause friction with the U.S.
Sherman will next visit Mongolia and then China for just the second high-level meeting between American and Chinese officials since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Environment and energy ministers from the group of 20 rich nations have gathered in Italy's southern city of Naples for a two-day summit on environment, energy and climate change. The talks, chaired by Italy, which holds the rotating annual presidency of the G20, have reportedly been inconclusive so far, as officials are struggling to find common ground to put together joint statements on the topics being discussed. On Thursday, Naples saw a number of anti-G20 protests being staged in different parts of the city. In the morning, hundreds of protesters tried to break into the building where the meeting was taking place. Activists from the campaign group Avaaz, wearing masks depicting Argentinian soccer player Diego Armando Maradona, staged a protest calling for debt relief for developing countries.
People are sick and tired of being lied to. Once again, it looks like there will be a complete lack of any commitments and money. The richest countries are telling the poorest countries we need to protect the environment, and the poorest countries are saying we need money for that.
The largest anti-G20 rally was held on Thursday afternoon in the historic center of Naples. Thousands of people from all walks of life shouted slogans against corporate greed and the influence of governments, and in support of a counter G20 summit. Speaking at the G20 ministerial meeting, Italian Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani said everyone wants to be green without making the necessary sacrifices. The minister added that if the financial system won't change in favor of sustainable development, there will be catastrophic consequences for future generations.
The Naples G20 meeting is seen as a key intermediate stage ahead of global climate talks known as COP26, UN Climate Change Conference. The meeting is to be held in Glasgow, UK, in November. Max Civili, Rome.
A
The long-awaited Olympic Games officially kicked off in Tokyo on Friday after a one-year postponement due to the coronavirus pandemic. The opening ceremony took place with no spectators in attendance and a reduced number of athletes joining the parade. Only fewer than 1,000 VIPs and officials were present at the Tokyo's National Stadium.